Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Rebecca Corral, midday news anchor for KCBS Radio in San Francisco and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Michael Chertoff, United States Secretary of Homeland Security. Michael Chertoff has served as the nation's Homeland Security Chief since February of last year. He's only the second to hold that cabinet seat. Secretary Chertoff has had a long and distinguished career in the public sector. He came to the cabinet from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, where he served as a United States Circuit Judge. Prior to that, Secretary Chertoff worked in the Bush administration as Assistant Attorney General at the Department of Justice. As a member of the DOJ's Criminal Division, he helped trace the 9/11 terrorist attacks to the Al-Qaeda network. He worked to increase information sharing within the FBI and with state and local law enforcement. Before joining the Bush administration, Secretary Chertoff served as a special counsel for the U.S. Senate Whitewater Committee. He's also spent time in the private sector as a partner in the law firm of Latham & Watkins during the 1990s. Prior to that, Secretary Chertoff spent more than a decade as a federal prosecutor on the East Coast. It is there where he investigated and prosecuted several significant cases of political corruption, organized crime, and corporate fraud. Secretary Chertoff graduated from Harvard College and Harvard Law School. Following that, he began his law career clerking for Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, Jr. Secretary Chertoff is married to Meryl Justin and has two children. Please join me now in welcoming Secretary of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff.
Well, thank you very much for that for that kind introduction, and I want to thank the club for inviting me. I know this was arranged a little bit on short notice, and it's a pleasure for me to be here. I also want to acknowledge St. Patrick's Day, in case you notice I'm wearing a green tie. That is not a coincidence. That's part of a conspiracy. And I'm sure you'll all go out and have a good St. Patrick's Day after my remarks. I actually have spoken to the Commonwealth Club before. 8 months ago, I addressed this forum in Silicon Valley and talked about our vision for moving the Department of Homeland Security forward and making our nation more secure. Today, I'm back to provide an update on where we stand and how we are applying the critical lessons of the last year. In particular, I'd like to focus on two near-term priorities that are particularly relevant for people here in California: boosting emergency preparedness, including the ability to plan and prepare for catastrophic events, and protecting our seaports through a layered security strategy. Now, I know that Californians are certainly not strangers to the need for emergency preparedness. You see everything in this state from earthquakes and wildfires to floods and mudslides, and sometimes all of those things happen in the same month. And, of course, I can't help but notice that this year marks the 100th anniversary of one of the worst natural disasters ever to strike our nation, the Great San Francisco Earthquake of 1906. The memory of that disaster will, I am sure, forever be etched into the consciousness of this city as it is of the entire nation. Last year, our nation witnessed another 100-year event, Hurricane Katrina. And make no mistake about it, Katrina will go down in history, justifiably, as the most devastating natural disaster in terms of size and scope since the 1906 earthquake or the 1900 Galveston hurricane.
This is a sham covering up crimes against humanity. Michael Chertoff and the Bush regime are guilty of mass murder in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. The world can't wait. Drive out the Bush regime. The world can't wait. Drive out.
Some people started St. Patrick's Day a little bit on the early side. Now, we do know that an earthquake, unlike a man-made event, cannot be prevented. Sometimes we may have indications that one is coming, but even with the most sophisticated equipment, we can't predict with any reasonable degree of certainty when, where, or if one will happen, or even its ultimate impact. The San Francisco earthquake, for example, was actually two disasters in one, the initial earthquake, and then the subsequent fire, which actually caused most of the damage to the city and left about half of the population homeless. It's therefore incumbent on us as government leaders, as businesses, and especially as individuals, to be prepared for earthquakes, for other natural disasters, or even for man-made disasters, and to make sure that we have fully coordinated plans and capabilities that will enable an effective response. Many Americans are also rightly concerned about different kinds of threats, emerging threats like avian flu and the potential for a worldwide pandemic. And along the Gulf Coast, there's great concern about hurricane season that starts less than 90 days away on June 1st. Now, you don't have to worry about hurricanes here in California, at least I don't think you do, but I do know you have more than your fair share of unique hazards. Earlier today, Governor Schwarzenegger and I took a tour of this state's levee system, which, as I am sure you know, could endanger lives and cause significant damage to surrounding areas. Earlier today, Governor Schwarzenegger and I took a tour of this state's levee system, which, as I'm sure you know, could endanger lives and cause significant damage to surrounding areas if it failed. All these hazards underscore an important point about disasters and, indeed, catastrophic events. While we can do many things at the federal level to try to mitigate their impact, disasters will first and foremost be felt at a local level, and the emergency response will be driven by state and local officials and first responders. And that's why it's absolutely critical that we work together to develop a set of integrated plans and preparedness measures among federal, state, and local partners, the business community, and individual citizens. To that end, we are now taking steps at DHS to make sure that states and major cities have at least a set of baseline capabilities for dealing with a catastrophic event. Last month, at the President's direction, we submitted our first report to Congress that provided a preliminary assessment, a self-assessment by the states, of catastrophic planning in each state and the largest 75 urban areas. Now, this assessment revealed mixed and uneven capabilities. And as I speak, we are conducting site visits by teams of Homeland Security professionals to work with states and cities to pinpoint vulnerabilities and weaknesses and to recommend changes. And we will submit this second phase report on June 1. So the first thing we have to do is make sure that we are boosting state and local preparedness. But we also need to make sure we're capable and ready at the federal level. Simply put, Katrina overwhelmed local, state, and federal capabilities with the size and scope of its devastation. And to remind you, approximately 90,000 square miles were hit by Katrina. That is roughly the size of the entire country of Great Britain. More people moved, or had to be moved, in the week that Katrina hit than any other mass evacuation in American history, with the exception of the Dust Bowl, which took place over decades. At one point, 1.5 million people were displaced by Katrina. The amount of debris that had to be cleared and collected, and that remains, and that includes that which remains to be cleared and collected, is more than the total amount of debris combined of Hurricane Andrew and of the 9/11 attack. The simple truth is that over the 25-year history of FEMA, a federal disaster response system that worked adequately for small and medium-sized events always seems to hit a wall when it comes to major catastrophes. And by the way, many of the criticisms leveled at FEMA after Katrina are eerily similar to the criticisms of FEMA after Hurricane Andrew back in 1992. And Katrina was many, many, many times Andrew in terms of scope and severity, loss of life, and damage to property. Shortly before Katrina hit, I outlined a vision for DHS that was focused on risk management and the need for the federal government to focus its limited resources on being able to respond to events with the greatest consequences. And I put before Congress and the American public a comprehensive strategy for focusing DHS on that challenge. That strategy was designed to kick off as a matter of law on October 1. But unfortunately, Mother Nature didn't wait for us to get our plans and capabilities in place. But now we're over 6 months later. So how do we apply the lessons of Katrina to get us ready for the next event? First, last month I announced some sweeping changes to the Federal Emergency Management Agency to give this vital agency the tools and resources it needs to support state and local response. And these are tools, by the way, that FEMA lacked for decades. The changes are designed to strengthen FEMA in five key areas. First, we've got to enhance our logistics capabilities so we can more effectively move and track supplies. Second, we have to strengthen our ability to process claims for disaster victims. Third, we have to build a more effective and more efficient debris removal process. Fourth, we have to create a more robust financial management system to protect against fraud. And finally, we have to build a reliable emergency communication system that will survive even a catastrophic hurricane so that we have the visibility we need to make really effective decisions when a disaster strikes. Within DHS, we've integrated all of our preparedness activities under a single preparedness directorate led by a very experienced former state homeland and emergency response advisor so that we can better coordinate our grants, training, exercises, and operations within state and local counterparts. And we are setting up regional offices to do that planning as closely as possible on the ground to those who have the first responder responsibilities at local and state levels. Finally, again and again, we will continue to emphasize the importance of a risk-based process for awarding our Homeland Security grants, making sure we are building the right critical capabilities in the right places based on risk and need and not based on pork. Over the long run, this risk-based approach will pay dividends at all levels of government. But one thing remains clear even when you put the federal, state, and local governments to one side. The burden of emergency response will never be entirely placed on government. Sure, government has a very clear responsibility to provide for the safety of its citizens, in particular, those who either don't have the means or the ability to rescue or care for themselves in a crisis. But the fact of the matter is, able-bodied individuals who are fully capable of providing for their own safe rescue need to take some responsibility for doing that. And there are two reasons to do that. First is selfish. You'll be out of harm's way much faster. The reality is that first responders will not always be able to get to every victim at every location within the first 48 to 72 hours of a disaster. But the second reason to do it is a matter of civic responsibility. Because when those who can take responsibility for themselves do so, they free up first responders to rescue those who cannot rescue themselves. And so we've done a great deal at the federal, state, and local level to encourage citizens and businesses to take steps to be more prepared. At DHS, we launched the Ready Campaign, which includes Ready America, Ready Business, Ready Kids, and Listo Spanish language versions to teach citizens as well as the business community the value of preparedness and to encourage them to take simple steps to be ready in the event of an unexpected emergency or disaster. Ready has been one of the most successful outreach campaigns in the Ad Council's history, generating more than $466 million in donated media support. And since its launch, the Ready.gov website has received almost 2 billion hits and more than 22 million unique visitors. In September, following Hurricane Katrina, approximately 290,000 unique visitors visited Ready.gov, a 50% spike from the prior month. And the Ready toll-free number has received over 252,000 calls, and more than 6 million sets of materials have been requested or downloaded. About 58% of Americans have taken at least one of the preparedness steps recommended by the campaign. This includes developing an emergency kit with necessary supplies, developing an emergency plan so you know what to do and where to go if there's an emergency, having a plan for staying in touch with your family members or coworkers, and if you're a business owner, steps to make sure you can keep your business running. Our Citizens Corps program as well, which provides emergency responder training, community exercises, and volunteer opportunities for citizens to assist first responders is active in all 50 states and 6 territories, covering more than 70% of the U.S. population. Here in California, there are more than 100 citizen corps councils, reflecting about 87% of the state population. In all, Citizen Corps serves nearly 205 million Americans. In many ways, California has been a model state for emergency preparedness. When I met with Governor Schwarzenegger, we discussed some of the efforts here, including First Lady Maria Shriver's preparedness campaign. Be smart, be responsible, be prepared, be ready. One of the many highlights of this successful campaign is that all students in the state of California will have disaster preparedness education. In fact, our nation's schools are one of the most valuable resources we have for spreading the message of preparedness, and I would encourage other states to adopt a similar program. I know the city of San Francisco has a preparedness campaign, 72hours.org, which is encouraging citizens to be ready for emergencies, and the Community Emergency Response Team Program, or CERT, which is an important part of our grassroots Citizen Corps effort, was created right here in California 20 years ago. Today, more than 2,000 CERT programs are training citizens across our country to assist first responders with 157 active programs in California alone. These are all important efforts. Other states and communities can and should follow California's lead. But we know that building a truly successful culture of preparedness across America will ultimately depend upon commitment by individuals and communities who decide to take action. The fact of the matter is, in the face of risks, we are not powerless and we are not without the ability to control our own fates. The first step to empowering ourselves and to controlling our fates, whether it be a natural disaster or a medical pandemic or even a terrorist act, is taking those basic steps, not expensive and not hard, to get yourself prepared for 72 hours with food and water and medicine, a radio, supplies, develop a plan about how and where family members would meet if separated, think through the kinds of things you need to have on hand if supplies are cut off for a period of time, and get educated about how to deal with the kinds of threats that we all face as humans, whether it be hurricanes, earthquakes, fires, or flus. I am, therefore, today going to challenge not only those in this state, but in other states, to continue to build upon a public preparedness outreach effort, to make it a core civic responsibility and a core element of personal empowerment to get prepared, to get educated, and to be ready if and when disaster strikes. Now, since I am here in the Port of San Francisco and across from the Port of Oakland, I'd like to switch gears for just a moment and discuss another issue that's gotten a lot of attention lately, and that's port security. And this is something that we've talked about for a long time. But in recent weeks, attention has been refocused on this because of the issue of foreign investments in our ports. This is, therefore, a good opportunity to step back and look in a more general sense at what we have done since 9/11 to strengthen port security and to identify those areas where more needs to be done. Now, there's no place where port security resonates more than here in the Bay Area. You've got critical ports right here in San Francisco and Oakland, which I had a chance to tour earlier today. California is also home to the busiest port complex in the country, Los Angeles, Long Beach. This state is a vital gateway for most of the goods entering our country from Asia and the East. And let me begin by making this very clear. A plan of port security that required us, in effect, to shut down the operation of the ports would be devastating for this state. It would put thousands and thousands of people out of work. We would be making the classic mistake of burning down the village in order to save it. The port security strategy we have been unrolling for the last year and that we will continue to unroll is a smart strategy, one that elevates our security, that exploits our technology, that takes advantage of our ingenuity, but that does not have us strangling ourselves because we don't want to let anything in on the basis of a fear that it might be dangerous. What we need to do instead, if we're going to do smart security, is look at the whole supply chain. How do goods begin their journey into this country, and how do they end their journey when they finally arrive? Effective port security requires a ring of defenses, a continuum of security measures that spans every step of that supply chain, from the time the container is stuffed and loaded on a ship until it is unloaded at a dock and sent into the stream of commerce. So how do we put together the elements of port security? Well, first, let's look at the physical security of the port itself, including its terminal operations and physical infrastructure. In this area, contrary to some misinformation, we don't outsource our security. It is the United States Coast Guard that sets the security standards, reviews facility and vessel security plans, and conducts inspections to make sure the ports and vessels, including foreign vessels operating in our ports, are in full compliance. To date, the Coast Guard has reviewed and verified more than 3,200 facility security plans at our nation's 360 ports and has boarded more than 16,000 foreign ships. Second thing we worry about at the port is what comes in, the cargo. We need to look at what's coming into the port to make sure it doesn't represent a threat. And the place to start looking is not beginning when it arrives, but beginning when it gets loaded overseas. So since 9/11, we've implemented a layered defense in depth so that all the cargo arriving at our ports has been thoroughly screened and vetted and, if necessary, physically inspected. We use intelligence and a risk-based strategy to screen 100% of the cargo bound for the United States by way of the seas. We require information about that cargo, including manifest information, 24 hours before the cargo is loaded on the ship overseas. That information is run through our National Targeting Center with its database of intelligence and a set of very sophisticated risk calculations to determine whether we should be concerned about the cargo and if it needs further scrutiny. In addition, we've done two further security steps to build in other layers. First, we have the Container Security Initiative, or CSI, and then the second is a partnership with private industry, the Customs Trade Partnership Against Terrorism, or CTPAT. Both of these programs are administered by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. CSI is now operational at 43 overseas ports, where our inspectors are working side by side with foreign counterparts to screen cargo bound for the U.S. and to inspect it, if necessary, before it even gets on the ship to make its way across the ocean here. By the end of this year, over 80% of container traffic bound for the United States will have been screened and, if necessary, inspected before it ever left a foreign country. On top of that layer of security, CTPAT, a private-public security partnership, now including 96 of the top 100 U.S. importers, focuses on building additional security measures with the private sector. That now represents 45% of all imports by volume, and we are on a path to complete all security validations of these partner companies next year. So we've built these additional layers into the program even before this cargo gets on the ship and gets into this country. When it's on the high seas, we can board that. And when it arrives in this country, we apply yet one more layer of defense to address that issue that I think people are most concerned about when they think about containers. And that is the possibility of radiological material or a nuclear device being smuggled into this country. We know that the thing that most scares people, and rightfully so, is the idea of a container as a vehicle for something so destructive that it would be devastating in this country. And the capability that best describes that kind of a threat is radiological material. So what we've done, and the evidence is right across the bay in Oakland, is we have turned to technology to enable us to detect nuclear material, radioactive emissions, before cargo leaves the port and gets into the stream of commerce. Oakland now screens and scans for radiation 100% of all containers that come into that port. Next year, we will reach close to that 100% mark in all of our seaports. And as we do that, we are continuing to develop next-generation technology that will get us more precise screening devices with fewer false positives and greater efficiency. To support this effort, undertaken as part of our domestic nuclear detection office, the President this year asked Congress for over $500 million that we can use to research and deploy next-generation radioactivity detectors. This is a 70% increase over 2006, and this is very important funding, which it's urgent that Congress provide. In addition, we have other technological devices. At ports of entry around the country, we've invested more than 170 non-intrusive inspection devices, basically big X-rays, that let you see what's in a container. And we've issued 12,400 handheld radiation devices, including those big portal monitors I've spoken about. This effort, technology, spending money to disperse that technology and roll it out, and then doing the research to the next generation of technology, is yet one more critical stage in guarding that supply chain against a terrorist attack or similar threat. Finally, we have one last element in this ring of defense that I've talked about. We need to be concerned about the people who might enter the ports from our side. Well, the Coast Guard here again looks both at the water side and the land side. The 96-hour rule enables Coast Guard to look at the manifests of crews of every ship coming into the ports and go onto the ships and validate the crews before anybody gets off the ship. We check those names against watch lists, and if we have a security concern about the crew of a vessel, we don't let the ship come in port. And the fact of the matter is, remember, whenever we talk about security at the ports, which is ultimately the responsibility of the Coast Guard, we back up our ability to control that security with maybe the most potent authority there is, our boats and our guns. On the land side, we are now moving to deploy the last piece of a comprehensive approach to protecting ourselves against threats, and that is the Transportation Worker Identification Credential. We recently completed two pilot programs aimed at identifying how we could make such a credential work for all the hundreds of thousands of people who come into our ports on a regular basis. This card and this credential, which was part of a program mandated by Congress, when it is rolled out, will streamline how we conduct background checks on workers, will include biometric technology so we can make sure that the cardholder is really who he or she says he or she is, and will give us a confidence level about people entering our ports, which I think we are entitled to expect. Now, I cannot tell you that this program has progressed as quickly as I might have hoped. But what I will tell you today is that we have now set an aggressive timetable to complete deployment of the TWIC card. Our goal and our objective is, and we will meet it, is to have these cards in the hands of port workers this year, with those workers undergoing background checks. And we are going to start that process in the very near future. Taking all of these measures together, overseas, on the high seas, when cargo arrives, security of the ports, when you take it all together, we have a layered defense for our ports that is much stronger than it would be if we simply relied on any single element of security. The fact of the matter is we have done a lot, and we have made a lot of progress in the last 2 years. And next year we will make yet additional progress, getting to our goal of the kind of security that is really as close to 100% as you can possibly get without disrupting the jobs and the trade, which is such an important part of the culture and economy of communities like the Bay Area. I want to step back and make a final observation. I've said this repeatedly, and I will always say it. We cannot eliminate every natural or man-made threat, and we cannot eliminate every risk. We cannot protect every single person against every danger in every place at every moment. If we were to try to do that, we would destroy our country. We would destroy our civil liberties. We would destroy our prosperity. We would destroy our way of life. The way to go forward in managing risk, therefore, without compromising our freedoms and without sacrificing our way of life, is to do it with an intelligent strategy that applies the right amount of risk protection and the right amount of resources in a way that works with and allows works with our prosperity, allows our civil liberties to flourish, but make sure at the end of the day we have dramatically reduced and protected ourselves against the great risks that really we have to be ultimately worried about. I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for inviting me to participate once again in this distinguished forum. I'd like to thank those of you here for your interest in preparedness and in security. It is ultimately not the responsibility of any single government official or even the whole government. It's a shared responsibility at every level. Thank you.
We're now going to begin the question and answer part of our program, and our thanks to U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff for his comments today. I'm Robert Rosenthal, the managing editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and I will be conducting the question and answer portions of our program. We've got a large number of questions here, Mr. Secretary, from the audience, so let's begin. What's the purpose of your trip today to California? And it's a multi-part question. And do you think that from what you've seen here and what you're aware of, that the Bay Area, local authorities, state authorities, and federal authorities are prepared for the major earthquake everyone expects to happen?
My trip was actually spurred by a meeting I had with the governor a couple of weeks ago, shortly after he announced his emergency declaration with respect to the levees. We sat down and he said that he thought it would be valuable for me as a fact-finding matter to really see for myself the challenge posed by the levees. So I came out to look at that, to meet with him, with the Army Corps of Engineers, with state officials, to see on the ground or from the air what the challenge is, to make sure that we are progressing on our joint planning for evacuation in the area. And then since I was out here, I thought I would actually see for myself the Oakland port, which, as I say, is the first one to get 100% of all containers screened for radiation. So it was kind of a dual trip, but spurred by my desire to see what is clearly a potential disaster that is very much on the governor's mind, I think on the mind of people everywhere. I think California traditionally has earned a lot of respect across the country for emergency preparedness. A lot of the doctrine of emergency preparedness originated here, and there's probably no state that sees as wide a variety of disasters as California, partly because of its size. I think California is well prepared, but I have to say I think we need to keep getting better prepared. We need to be better prepared because although the routine disaster, wildfires, things of that sort, mudslides, which we saw last year, are handled very capably with state and local authorities taking the lead, if there were to be a truly catastrophic event, a catastrophic earthquake or a collapse of a major levee and a major flood, it is foreseeable that the federal government would have to be able to step in and lend a very, very strong hand. The only way to do that is to plan together, train together, and exercise together so that we're not getting acquainted for the first time in the middle of the emergency. And that's why I've had tasked my people here in FEMA and in other parts of DHS, and why the Department of Defense has tasked its people to get with state officials to make sure we have got our plans well-coordinated and well-exercised.
To follow up on that, what's the chain of command that you would like to see in terms of this different authorities, and are you convinced that they can't communicate with each other in a situation where there's loss of power, upheaval, chaos, et cetera?
Well, first of all, let me begin by saying this. A catastrophe is never going to be an elegant exercise. They call it a catastrophe for a reason. It's bad. A lot of stuff is demolished. A lot of people die. And that's kind of the baseline. But there are two things we can do to make our response as good as it can be. One is technological. We've got to get better equipment out that can operate, even if all the communications and infrastructure goes down. That means satellite phones. It also means we have these trucks that we can actually now deploy in the field that have radio repeaters. We can beam up to airplanes or to cutters so that we can maintain some kind of physical communications architecture. The second piece, though, is what I call a cultural piece. Everybody's got to get physically or virtually in the same room. The way we operate command and control in an incident, and this is started in California, as we don't have a system of government, nor should we, where there's one czar who controls everything. We have a system where we learn to cooperate through an incident command system and an incident management system that brings everybody with the requirements and capabilities to the table, has somebody manage and coordinate, and then we make sure that we get what is needed to the people who need it as quickly as possible. That's a kind of set of relationships that requires not only a written plan, but constant exercising and training, and that's what we're doing as we speak.
Okay. We're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff. It's generally acknowledged that mistakes were made leading up to Hurricane Katrina's strike on New Orleans and the aftermath. What are the crucial lessons that you've learned from that?
I think that maybe the lesson I've learned the best is the one I just said. You can have a written plan, but if you don't exercise it and train it and build the personal relationships that make it work with fluidity, the plan is never going to be as good as it can be. The reality is people who are going to play the critical roles on the ground, in the field, need not only to know each other, but need to have worked the plan together, prepared together, and trained together so that when they actually have to become operational, they can do so seamlessly. Proof of that is Hurricane Rita. Through the rather, through the unfortunate crucible of Katrina, which did bring everybody together and get everybody well acquainted in the dynamic of a real event about how to coordinate, Rita was much, much more smoothly coordinated than Katrina. The lesson there is that preparedness and planning and training well in advance is the best way to go into a major catastrophe with as strong a set of capabilities as possible.
Okay. What's your greatest challenge right now as Homeland Security Secretary?
I would say the greatest challenge is being very clear about what we can do and what we should do and what we shouldn't do. Homeland Security requires what I call adult conversation, meaning not to have the pretense that somehow we're going to take care of everything. There will never be a terrorist attack. There will never be a catastrophe. Everything will proceed like on television. It'll be wrapped up in an hour. I don't really believe actually any American thinks that or wants that. I think sometimes government has a tendency to speak to Americans as if we're going to promise that. And one of the resolutions I made when I took this job was I wasn't going to do that. I was going to be honest about the fact that Homeland Security requires choices, and sometimes they're difficult choices. And sometimes you have to make the best of a bad set of choices. And so when we come to issues like security, for example, I don't want to come to the American people and say, we want a system of security that is a perfect system that will guarantee you nothing bad will ever happen, nothing can be smuggled in, no bad person will ever get into a building. Because to deliver on that promise, I would have to make this country unlivable. I would have to shut down everything that makes this country good. And that's not what we want to do. We would lose the war against terror if that was our approach. What I do want to say is, look, here are the things we have to be most worried about. Here are the ways we can most effectively prevent those challenges, protect against them, and respond to them. And here's how we can do it in a way that doesn't fundamentally compromise our way of life. The challenge for me is to make that case over and over again, even when the temptation is to treat a particular event as if somehow it requires that we now, you know, guarantee against any possibility of harm. And that's one of the reasons I come and speak at organizations like this, is because I think at the end of the day, people have a right to hear a realistic assessment of what the government should provide, and they should understand that there are always going to be tough choices. If the people in this country want to live in a state that's a garrison state, they could choose that, but I don't think that's the choice people want to make. And that's why what we talk about is a risk-managed approach that is sensible and not one that overreacts.
There's a general consensus that avian flu will be here. What advanced preparations are being made to combat that and, again, coordinate between local, state, and federal authorities?
Every week, representatives of the Department of Health and Human Services, which has the lead responsibility for human health at the federal level in this country, representatives of my department, representatives of the Department of Agriculture, go out to the different states and cities to meet with Homeland Security advisors, public health officials, and emergency managers to talk about avian flu. And what we're trying to do is get everybody focused on the kind of preparation they have to do to play their role in what would be a potentially very challenging event if we had worst-case pandemic avian flu. That means how would we deal with medical issues? How would we distribute vaccine when we get vaccine? How would we deal with care if we were overwhelmed with the need to put people in hospitals and we have constrained resources? How would we deal with keeping critical infrastructure, food, water, power running if people were so afraid they stayed home and didn't go to work? You know, one of the lessons that I see in my job is it's not only the obvious threat you have to worry about, it's the threat that you don't think about. Sometimes the reaction people have in panic is worse than the actual thing they're panicked about. And if everybody were to stay home because of a fear of avian flu, and no one drove the trucks to bring the groceries, and no one turned the water on, and no one turned the power on, we would have a very bad situation here. We have a national strategy to deal with this. It requires that we get state and local officials focused on this. We are building, Congress has appropriated billions of dollars to do research and produce vaccine and antiviral drugs. We are working on a plan to deal with border control if we have an incident like this. The USDA, which has a lot of experience dealing with similar types of bird flus and has done it quite successfully, containing epidemics, is very well prepared for what is likely to be the first intrusion of a bird flu, which would be a wild bird or even a domestic chicken that was infected. All of these things together are part of a plan that we are spending a lot of time on. Let me come back, though, to individuals. In the end, every individual is going to have to take responsibility for their part in this, and that means getting educated, going onto the web. HHS has a website, DHS has a website. See the kinds of things you need to know. If we had an event, we may never have one. We may never have human-to-human transmission. There would be simple things like social distancing, how you behave with other people, how you sterilize things, how you cook things. That would be important to know. And if people educated themselves, that would have a huge impact in empowering them to control the risks that they face.
One of the things you came to talk to the governor about today were the levees. What, I mean, specifically, do you think the levees in California, what kind of shape are they in, and is the federal government going to be prepared to help out if necessary?
Well, I'm an engineer. I mean, the Army Corps has gone around and assessed them. I gather there are 24 points at which they believe that there are critical problems with particular levees. The Army Corps is prioritizing the work on this project with the state, and you know, the general was with me as we took the tour. We obviously do want to stand with the state in terms of getting assistance, engineering assistance, and money to help the state do what it has to do. The state obviously also has a significant responsibility here as well, and we want to make sure that we can cut through red tape in terms of getting necessary work done. But the second part of this is, it's not going to be done overnight. So if tomorrow we have a levee break, we need to have a plan in effect that will evacuate people and mitigate the damage. And that's the piece that my department has responsibility for working with the state on, and we're doing that as we speak.
Okay. ABC News reported this morning that in random security checks at 21 airports around the United States, all failed, that bomb-related material got through. Are you aware of this, and what do you think about that?
Well, I'm aware there's a leaked report, a leaked version of a report, which I haven't seen, so it's always hard to comment on that. Some of this is what we sometimes call the MacGyver theory. That, you remember that show MacGyver? I mean, if you got a guy who's really a genius and you could take household chemicals and he could make bombs out of them, I mean, that would be awfully tough to deal with. So, you know, we want to make sure we're not overreacting. But I will agree with the bottom line premise. We have recognized for the last year that the big danger at this point on airplanes is no longer someone taking over the airplane because you have a locked cockpit door, it's armored, you have air marshals on the plane. We ought to turn our focus more to explosives, and particularly sophisticated explosives. We've done a lot of work in explosive detection in terms of new technology and, of course, increased use of dogs. But we've got more work to do in terms of being more efficient and more effective in detecting new technologies. So that's why we took the step of retraining the screeners to start to move them away from looking for things like nail clippers to dealing with more sophisticated chemicals and detonating devices. So, again, you know, there is no perfect security. If everybody had to go on the plane naked, I guess that would be perfect security. But it would be kind of foolish. So what we want to do is come up with an approach and a plan that detects the things we're really worried about, explosives, using technology, using dogs, and using the right training.
Should any of us or you be surprised if in the next day or in 2 minutes from now we got word that a dirty bomb or there was a chemical incident with terrorists in this country, if it happened, would that be a surprise to any of us, or should it be?
You know, I don't think anybody could be surprised by anything after September 11th. I think that we live with the ever-present risk of something happening. Obviously, some risks are greater than others. I mean, we know someone could walk into a store and shoot somebody because it happens all the time. And whether that person was doing it because they're a terrorist or because they're just mentally deranged, I don't know that it would make a lot of difference to the victims. On the other hand, we do very, very closely monitor, from an intelligence standpoint, weapons of mass destruction. Obviously, the thing we're most concerned about is, are there nuclear devices out there? Is there loose radiological material? Are there chemical weapons out there that would cause a significant amount of damage? I think the answer is that is where most of the focus of our intelligence activity is, most of the focus of our protection is. In terms of what we worry about when we look at things coming into the country, frankly, that's what we worry about. I don't worry about someone bringing a handgun into the country because they can get one here. But things that are more powerful and harder to get here are the things we really need to keep out of this country.
Okay. We're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is U.S. Secretary of the Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff. Continuing on our cheery conversation, what can you generally tell us about the government's ability to clamp down Al-Qaeda's activities in the U.S.? Is that the key to protecting us from Al-Qaeda, or is the key abroad? And how safe, well, I want to ask that in terms
of... Well, this is another example of layers. You don't want to rely on one thing. You start overseas. When we kill or capture Al-Qaeda, we strike a devastating blow. We knock out their leadership. We get information about their plans. We find out the identity of other operatives. So that is clearly where we want to go first. On the other hand, we obviously are very concerned about cells in this country that might become operational. You know, in July of last year, the British experienced attacks in the subways that by all accounts came from people that appeared to be perfectly normal, integrated members of the community and who turned out to become operators who killed a significant number of people. That is a lot of the focus of our intelligence activity, is identifying who operatives are, who are people who are, affiliated or have financial connections with terrorist groups, who not only would support active operatives if they came in, but might become operational themselves. I think that one good news story is our information sharing is much, much better now than it was in 2001. In fact, it's better now than it was when I came on the job a year ago. We actually do fuse and integrate the information with much more ease than we did before 9/11 came. And that's an example of how constant training and exercising and experience makes us better.
In terms of what you're talking a lot today about defensive actions and potential offensive actions around the world against terrorist operations, but how strong or how much commitment should be made to also investing in addressing the root causes from a political and economic point of view that create this adversarial relationship we're existing in today?
Well, I mean, there's no question that in the end, the long-term solution in part here is creating societies in which people don't become terrorists. There clearly is an ideology in the world that it tells its adherents or indoctrinates its adherents into a view of life that basically goes like this. Everything you do ought to be controlled by a kind of an ideological doctrine. Women should be shut up in burqas and punished if they learn how to read. Democracy is a bad thing. Freedom is a bad thing. And evidently there are some people who, for whatever reasons, become enamored of that doctrine. We've got to change that, and I think part of the way to change that is to bring freedom and the rule of law around the world as an example. Fundamentally, I share this view that people are, human beings have more in common than they have different. And I think what most people want is a life where they can be free to go about their business and pursue their happiness and be safe and have, some control over what they do. I think as we speak that message, as we go out there and promote democracy and the rule of law, that is a long-term strategy that will yield positive dividends. But I also have to say this. I would not kid myself into believing that you will convert everybody. There will be some people who will always, for whatever reason in their psychology, want to adhere to an ideology that is one of death and destruction. And you can't appease them, and you're not going to appeal to their better nature because they've locked themselves into an ideology of hatred and death. And those people we simply have to incapacitate.
We're talking a lot about the war on terror. You certainly are, and we've been talking about the war on drugs for decades. Is this a winnable war, especially when you frame it in cultural and the different values that you're addressing in terms of the world we're facing now? And are we trying to impose a different value set on people who really have no comprehension of our values, just as we can't really comprehend theirs?
Well, I don't think our view of the war on terror is that we're trying to impose our values on other people. I think what we do think is a minimum requirement is that they not impose death on us. You've got to begin with the proposition that on September 11th, we didn't provoke September 11th. And if you read anything bin Laden wrote, it was our existence that provoked September 11th. If you go back and look at what Ramzi Youssef, who was one of the architects of terror against this country, said, just our existence as a free society, the fact that women can walk around uncovered was an offense to people, and they thought the reaction is to kill us. So the minimum win here is not to let that happen. But I, as I said earlier, I think in the long run, the world does better if freedom of the rule and the rule of law and tolerance and respect become a worldwide issue, because then we don't have to be on guard all the time.
Several of the questions asked, what inspires you, and can you ever have 10 minutes of relaxation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I tell you what inspires me. I was the head of the criminal division when 9/11 hit. And I remember I was in the FBI Operations Center with Director Mueller. I think the Attorney General was in the Midwest at that point trying to get back. And I remember that absolute sense of horror at watching the Twin Towers collapse with thousands of lives lost. The sense of not having any idea that this had been at root in our country. We had so many years without having a terrorist attack of any kind of success. And not knowing what else was out there. Was this the first wave or the second wave or the third wave? I remember that, for example, there were rumors that the taxi drivers in Washington had plots to park their cabs in front of buildings and blow them up. And that sense of powerlessness, loss of friends, I think really made me understand or changed my view, my professional view of what was important. It seemed what was important was to deal with the issue of terror in a way that would protect this country, but also, frankly, to do it in a way that doesn't destroy this country. I think from the very beginning I thought it was important that we build the right kind of architecture of security and homeland security, so it's one we are happy to live with, because I think it's pretty evident to me, and it's probably evident to most of you, this is going to go on for a long time. So when you ask me what inspires me, it's not that I don't understand there's a lot of vigorous disagreement about individual things we do, or that it's frustrating, or that as a matter of the odds, the odds are very much against the idea that we can have perfect security. The idea there will be at least a low-level attack at some point seems, pretty obviously reasonable. So if what I was looking to do was, take something that would be a kind of a clear, you could declare a clear win and go home, this was absolutely the wrong job. But if it was to be part of what I think is a very, very important mission for people in our generation, which is to build the right kind of architecture for security, then what inspires me is all the other people I get to work with who devote 24/7 to this, whether they be in the Coast Guard or Customs or the FBI or whatever. And that's, I think, what I keep in my mind.
Do you have a voice in environmental controls when it comes to homeland security and the whole issue of global warming? Obvious interest here in California, the possibility that rising oceans will affect our coastlines.
That's one of the few things I don't have in my portfolio. We have a head of EPA. We do obviously look at the issue of natural disasters because we have to be prepared for those, whether they be earthquakes or mudslides or hurricanes or tsunamis. the cycle of hurricanes, for example, apparently goes like a wave. I mean, there are periods of 15 or 20 years where they go up and then they go down, and we apparently are in an uptick here. So although I'm not a scientist and we don't do environmental stuff, we certainly consider all the environmental threats in terms of determining what kinds of catastrophes we have to be prepared for.
Could you comment on President Bush's domestic spying programs and why that's been beneficial for Homeland Security? And do you understand, and can the administration understand, the public's outrage toward this program in some areas?
I understand one of the frustrations is, of course, when you deal with a classified program, you can't talk about it, and that always creates a difficult issue for the government. What has been said publicly, which is all I will say, is this is a program targeted on international calls where one party is outside the country, and focused on connections with people who there's reason to believe are affiliated with al-Qaeda. Let me step back and put the issue this way. One of the big challenges that emerged on 9/11 is not only are you looking for a needle in a haystack because you've got millions of people and only a few want to do us harm, but those few have the ability to do a lot of harm. But the needle doesn't even look like a needle. The needle is trying to disguise itself like a stalk of hay. So the key here is intelligence, and intelligence is like the radar of the 21st century. So when we can broaden our intelligence and get leads or information about someone who is in contact with al-Qaeda or has sent money to a place associated with al-Qaeda, that gives us the ability to do some investigation that may avert a disaster. Now, if it's innocuous, then people get rid of it and move on to the next thing. I mean, no one has an interest or the time to hunt down innocent people because we've got our hands full hunting down people who are dangerous. But the other thing I want to say more generally is this. Sometimes we debate the issue of privacy and we don't realize that there is privacy on both sides of what we talk about doing. We've had various programs at times to try to gather a little bit more information about travelers so we could refine our various screening programs. For example, if we can get, in addition to name, a date of birth, and a social security number, we can eliminate a lot of the false positives that cause people to get irritated when they go to the airport, and because they have the same name as a terrorist, they get pulled aside and they get questioned. Now, there's a lot of resistance to giving even this little bit amount of information to the government or to the airlines because it invades privacy. But I think you could make the argument that it's actually worse for privacy to be pulled aside and asked questions because you turned up as a false positive than to give a little bit more information and not be pulled aside. So that's a case where I think it's a trade-off between two kinds of privacy. And there again, it's an issue of, I think, having an intelligent conversation about what the real trade-offs are. There's no perfect solution. Every choice has upsides and downsides. I think if we had that conversation more openly and more honestly, we would be happier with where we strike the balance.
Okay. Does illegal immigration pose a threat to Homeland Security, and what do you think of an idea of a border fence on our border with Mexico?
Well, obviously, controlling our borders and keeping people out who are terrorists or criminals is a very important and good thing. On the other hand, we have to recognize that there's a huge economic draw in this country that is pulling people to come to do work that apparently nobody else is willing to do. And fighting that draw using only the tools of enforcement is a very expensive and difficult route, which is why the president has supported a comprehensive approach to migration, which does involve increased interception at the border and interior enforcement, but also looks to some way to take temporary workers on a temporary basis and regularize them so they can be legal within a framework that allows us to know who they are, and then we can focus on those people who want to sneak across the border not to work but to do us harm. So, yes, there's a national security element. What we are trying to do is focus on the security element and not just on kind of a general economic element. As far as a fence is concerned, I just don't think a fence works, a brick-and-mortar fence or a wire and barbed wire fence. A virtual fence, which is what we're headed to, is one which combines high technology, visibility, the ability to use satellite imagery or UAVs, sensors, to detect intrusions and then to apprehend people. But it doesn't put a lot of barbed wire on the border. Barbed wire on the border is simply not particularly useful. People cut through it. Even in the areas where we do have fencing, because they're right near urban areas, the fence doesn't do much more than slow up the illegal migrant by about 2 or 3 minutes. So fences only work when we have very intense Border Patrol policing presence to come right in when someone goes over the fence. If we built a fence across, 700 miles or 1,000 miles, we'd have to actually hire a lot more police to get up against the fence. Otherwise, the fence would simply serve no purpose. So here's an example of where I'm for doing something smart, but that may not necessarily mean the most obvious thing.
Okay. FEMA warned of a terrorist attack on New York. FEMA warned of a disastrous hurricane in New Orleans. So, and FEMA warned that there'll be a big one in the Bay Area.
I didn't realize FEMA had warned about the 9/11 attacks.
Was it an attack, warning of attack on a terrorist attack, a major terrorist attack on the United States in New York?
I mean, I think there was warning in general, someday there'll be a terrorist attack on the United States. That's a far cry from FEMA warned that there'd be an attack in New York. That would be a revelation, I think, to a lot of people, including the 9/11 Commission. I'm sorry, but I didn't...
That's fair, but the point of the question is this: New Orleans, Northern California, major earthquake. So in terms of those warnings, and you sort of addressed this earlier, but how does what you've seen here again compare to the preparedness in Louisiana prior to Katrina? Are we better prepared, and are you pretty sure of that?
You know, I think this state is well prepared, but that doesn't mean perfectly prepared. And so I want to come back to what I said earlier. Begin with the fact that, you know, if an earthquake hit, if you're unlucky, now I guess Northridge was comparatively lucky because it hit around 4 or 5 in the morning. But if an earthquake hit the Bay, you know, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a work day, there'd be a big problem. And, I mean, no matter how well prepared you are, it's going to be ugly. And that's the reality. But I do think that we can increase our ability to respond effectively by building on the preparedness now. A good deal of this is planning. You've got to really figure out, you've got to ask all the questions like, where are people going to go? What are you going to do if food and water becomes unavailable? How are you going to get medical care in? Once you've asked all the right questions and you've figured out what your requirements are going to be, you got to figure out who has the capabilities. A lot of them are local and state, and that's where they should be. Sometimes, though, we need to reach out to other states or to the federal government to supply some additional resources. Once you've laid that plan out, then everybody can come to the table and they can say, okay, we're going to have, if and when you need something because of an earthquake, and it goes beyond your capacity, we're going to have positioned at such and such a place, you know, 10 helicopters, and we'll send those. Or we're going to have the ability within 12 hours to move medical teams from other parts of the country into the area. We are on the way to getting that kind of preparation. We're not there yet, but we're better off than we were a year ago. But I can't leave this without just being very honest about something. It's not going to happen in an hour. If we had even the best prepared plan in the world that said bring medical teams from around the country into the Bay Area would not bring them in 6 hours. People have got to leave their homes or their hospitals. They've got to get to the airport. They've got to get their equipment on. The planes have to take off. They have to fly across the country. They have to land. That's why we come back to the fact that in that first 24 to 48 hours, people may often have to be quite self-reliant. And that's why planning always starts at the lowest level, and you try to deal with issues in the first instance on the ground while you wait for the cavalry to come from outside.
That's going to end our program for today. And our thanks to U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Michael Chertoff for his comments. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. I'd like to remind everyone to please remain seated until Secretary Chertoff has left the room. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Managing Editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.